They actually do pay me, yeah. So we're joking around here with, who are you?
Anders Heilsberg, chief randomizer on the C-sharp team.
Yeah.
Cool.
And what are we
here? Yeah, what are we doing here?
What are we doing here?
So we're also here with Dan Fernandez.
Oh, yeah.
Product manager. On the C-sharp team.
Yeah.
And last time we talked to Anders, this last couple times we talked about the need for to make it easier for those of us writing in, say, C-sharp to interact with SQL. And you had mentioned something briefly about, well, we're thinking about that for C-sharp 3.0, blah, blah, blah. Now we have Project Link. What's going on?
Well, so we thought about it. Yeah, I mean, so we talked about the big disconnect between databases and general-purpose programming languages, and that's effectively what we've worked on for the last 24 months. And now at the PDC, we are showing the first preview of the LINQ project. LINQ stands for, it's L-I-N-Q, for Language Integrated Query, and it's effectively, sort of, in a nutshell, it is taking query set operations and transforms and making them first-class concepts in the .NET framework.
Okay.
And that means, you know, in the CLR itself, it means in programming languages, in APIs, and so forth, such that you get a completely unified query experience across objects and XML and data, all the various forms that data occurs in your applications.
So now, what does it look like? I mean, I'm thinking of, you know, say, select star from some table where, what does that look like in C-sharp?
Well, we'll take a look in a little bit here. I'll show you what the code looks like. But let me first talk a little bit about how it sort of differs from traditional approaches to this. I mean, and indeed, you know, like select star from or whatever. Yes, you may have written that. And if you think back, maybe it wasn't so long you wrote it, but you probably wrote it in quotes, you know, and you gave it as an argument to new SQL command of select star, blah, 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 with placeholders for the arguments, et cetera, et cetera.
Precisely.
And of course, when you wrote it, there was no compile time type checking, nor was there any IntelliSense or anything, because effectively, you have sort of the language you're writing in, C#, and then you have the language in quotes, SQL, which is not at all understood in that context. And that sort of just sort of scratches the surface to illustrate the deep mismatches that we have between the data domain and the object domain. It's not just that the integration story is kind of funny in that you have a language within the other language, but also at a deeper level, like things like objects versus relational algebra, nullable types versus not, different standard functions, different data types. You know, everything is different between these two domains, and we can do so much better by integrating the world so that when you write your queries in C#, it's like a natural part of the C# language. You know what I mean? And when you write your predicates, like where you want to say where, blah, 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 well, it's a C# expression of type bool that you're writing there in terms of, you know, the stuff that you're querying and so forth. And you get IntelliSense, you get compile time type checking, and you get to write the queries not just against your database, but also against an in-memory array of customers that you have using exactly the same syntax or against an XML document. So that's sort of where we're going with this stuff.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. Now, clearly, have you been working with the SQL team, because they've done some interesting work in 2005 with being able to write stored procedures in C#.
Uh-huh.
And work like that. So I'm sure you guys have worked together at all, or?
Well, we talk all the time, obviously.
Sure,
obviously. And the SQL CLR support in UConn is sort of laying the foundation for hosting managed code inside SQL Server. The stuff we're showing here is sort of like, what could you do with that in the future? And so far, we're outside the server itself, so this stuff that I'm going to demo you here and the bits we're handing out at the PDC all run on the mid-tier, not inside the server. But going forward, that is absolutely a direction that we're looking at.
Fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
So, shall we look at some code?
Sure.
We can always talk more, too.
No. Let's look at some code here. So what I have here is just a little program that has some sample data in this particular case here. It's just an array of customers that I gotten from somewhere. It doesn't actually matter where they came from. I could have just nude them up right now. And customers have, you know, names and addresses and an embedded collection of orders and so forth. And now I'm going to try and write some queries against this stuff.
Okay.
My first little query is just going to say, give me all the customers, and then I'm going to call my object dumper, which is a little piece of code written using Reflection that just dumps the contents of my customers. So if I try and run this, here you'll just see a list of all the customers, and you'll see this is actually all the Northwind customers that I've just put into objects, and it has, you know, they each have a bunch of properties. The first thing you note here is var q equals customers. Var is local variable type inference, so this is basically the ability to declare local variables and have their type be inferred from the value that you assign to them. So this is exactly the same as saying customer array q equals customer,
okay,
because customers is of type customer array.
All right.
Anyway, let me first try and query here. And the first thing I'm going to do is maybe filter this down to fewer customers, maybe those that are in the City of London. So I can say dot where, and then C, calling the customer C, C.city equals London. And let's try and run this. And now you see my list of customers is down to fewer. Indeed, if we scroll sidewards here, we can sort of see that they're all in the City of London. Now I could apply another operator. Let me actually put this on separate lines here. And then apply a select operator, again calling the customer C, give me C.company name. Now let's try and run this. And now we just see the company names of the customers in London.
Interesting.
So if you've done some C# coding, you're gonna wonder what the hell is this stuff? What is it he's writing here? So first of all, the argument to where and the argument to select are lambda functions or lambda expressions, we call them. And they're effectively an evolution of anonymous methods that are present in C# 2.0.
Okay.
In this case here, though, we have even more type inference than we used to. So what I'm really writing here is a little function that takes a customer C as an argument and returns C.city equals London, which is of type bool, which the where operator wants to see.
Absolutely.
Now, but you'll note that we can infer what the type of C is. So you don't have to say customer C, delegate of customer C, open curly, return, blah, 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 blah. You just write it, you know, right in there, in situ, and we infer all of the types that surround it. Same is true for the select guy here. Now, the second thing you're going to wonder is, like, where did this where come from in this select guy, you know, because an array doesn't have a where or a select method. And a new feature we have in C# 3.0 is what we call extension methods, which is the ability to extend an existing type with new methods. And this sort of sounds like magic, but it's actually just based on some simple lookup rules for static methods.
Okay.
And the way it works here is that because I'm importing the namespace system.query, mm-hmm, and because system.query defines a bunch of extension methods,
okay,
like where and select, that all work on anything that implement IEnumerable of T, then because arrays implement IEnumerable of T for some T, I get wheres and selects. And I, in fact, get a whole library of methods like order by, group by, any, all, et cetera, et cetera. You know? And these methods all compose to form a complete query language that I can apply to any .NET array or collection.
Fantastic. So generics actually laid the foundation for this.
Deep enabler in this, yes,
yeah,
because generics make the type system rich enough now that we can express all the flow of type information that has to occur in a query.
Very cool.
Now, even so, you might go, gosh, this is looking a little geeky, you know, with these arrows and stuff and whatever. And so on top of these query methods, we have a thing that we call query expressions. And that's effectively the ability to write these queries using a more query-like syntax. You asked earlier, does it look like SQL or what does it look like? Well, let me show you what it looks like. I could write this very same query as like this. Var q equals from C in customers where C.city equals equals London. Select C.company name. And it would mean precisely the same. Now, the way this works, and my analogy here is, think of the for each statement that I'm sure you've used a gazillion times,
right?
Yep.
Yes.
Now, for each is actually a pattern over first calling get enumerator and then emitting a while statement that calls move next on the enumerator and obtains the current property and so forth. And you don't actually think about that day to day. You just use for each.
Exactly.
The same is true here. This is the same, but for queries.
Okay.
When you write from, where, select, we turn it into calls to the where method and the select method on the collection that you're querying underneath. But you don't have to think about that. That's
cool.
Just an implementation detail. And the method could be implemented by the collection itself, or it could be an extension method, as is the case here, and it could actually come from somewhere else. And that's how we get query syntax for any arbitrary collection.
Now, does it have to follow that pattern? Because logically, after doing so much SQL, I'd want to say select first, then from, then where.
Yes.
Does it matter?
Does matter.
It does matter.
From comes before select, unlike SQL. Now you go, why is that? Well, think of a couple of things. First of all, what if I were to write select, and now I want statement completion. What am I going to show you here?
Oh, okay.
Every variable in the universe, we don't know where it's coming from yet.
Understood.
So there's a bit of a problem with the flow of things in SQL. You need to know the from clause before you can give help on the select clause.
Okay.
And logically, SQL is funny in that the scope of the variable flows backwards. You introduce it in the from clause, but it is in scope above the from clause.
True.
So things don't come in a natural order in SQL.
Okay.
And we've reordered such that things flow, scope flows down, like it always does in your program, and things happen in the order you say them. First you take things from somewhere, then you filter them, and then you select stuff out of them.
Okay.
Now if you look at XQuery, you'll note that they actually have the same ordering of the operators as well. So it's not like we're treading completely uncharted ground here. There's precedent for this. And there's some more reasons for why it's important to have the select at the end when it gets into hierarchical queries and so forth, where the select cost can get very, very large.
Okay.
And you really want to see what's in scope before you write this large body of code in the select. But anyway, just to sort of show you, let me delete the first version of the query here and then try and run. And you'll see, boom, we get the same result. And in fact, if you were to look at the IL, it's precisely the same code. Now, the next thing you're going to want to look at here is projections. So in SQL, you can select X, Y, C from some table.
Absolutely.
And whatever, and you can effectively create structural types on the fly, you know, just by selecting a variety of columns out of your table. Now, in the object world, there is no notion of structural types, at least not in the .NET type system.
Okay.
And what we would do here instead is we would convert objects from one type to another in order to project. That would be the analogy. So if I have a bunch of customers here, and let's say I want to create a phone list out of it, well, I would effectively project into maybe a new contact class that I've written. So I might say select new contact of c.companyName, c.phone, if you see what I'm saying. And that would be my projection. I would change my array of customers into a sequence of contacts, and I picked out company name and phone.
Okay.
Of course, now I would have to go write this contact class.
Absolutely.
And introduce constructors and properties and so forth, and that's a bit of a pain, you know, if you had to write a new class for every select statement that you wrote.
Agreed.
Now, to alleviate that, what we support is now this thing we call anonymous types. So I can simply say new, open curly, and close curly here. And what I'm doing here is I am saying, give me an instance of something that has two fields or two properties, company name and phone, and then just project them out from the customers, and then give me back a sequence of that. Now this thing I'm creating here is just like any CLR class. It's just that it's created by the compiler instead of having been created by me. And its shape is inferred from how I used it in the query. And then the query gives me a sequence of those back. And here we see local variable type inference comes to the rescue. Since I can't say the name of this type, local variable type inference allows me to not say it and still be strongly typed.
Okay.
Now let's first try and run it, and you'll see the shape of this is, yes, I now have a sequence of something that has company name and phone, two fields. And it's strongly typed because I found these field names through reflection. Indeed, in here I could have written for each, var X in Q. Console.WriteLine of X dot company name, for example. And once the IDE gets aware enough of these extensions, there would actually be statement completion right here. So when I said X dot, it would show me company name and phone. Those are the two fields that are available. And if I run here, you'll see that I just get the company names. If I introduce an error, you'll see that I actually get an error message. The compiler has type checked this stuff. So this isn't late bound script like stuff. Even though I never set a type anywhere, the type has flowed out of my query and into my for each, and the compiler knows what's going on. So this is sort of like the difference between doing it the easy way with no typing, or doing it the hard way where the type is there, but you don't have to say it all the time.
Very nice.
Okay, let me just show you a few more things. One of the things that's interesting, of course, in the object world is that we have hierarchical data. Mm-hmm. And I could, in here, for example, well, actually, let me start in one way and say from C in customers and then also from O in C.orders, because customers have an orders collection. So let me effectively join customers with their own orders. And then from that, select out the company name, o.orderDate, and o.total. And let's try and run this. And you'll see now a sort of SQL-like shape of result where I have repetition in the outer column.
Okay.
Because I'm seeing the orders of the customers in London. And of course, the company name repeats many times. Now, I could actually introduce another predicate here and say o.orderDate.year equals 1997, run this, and now we only get those orders that are in 1997. Now, this is a very SQL-like shape of result, sort of rectangular, do you know what I mean? Just rows and columns.
Absolutely.
But one of the things that's key about objects is that we have hierarchical shapes of data. It's very, very common when you code with objects, you know, to have nested collections and so forth. And we support that ability in our query language here as well. So I could change this query to say, from each customer, select and project out company name, and then project out orders equals, and then let's take this guy and make it a subquery that's nested.
That's, I was just going to ask about that.
Statement completion is still sort of fighting me a little bit on the indentation here, but we'll put it where it's supposed to go, like so.
Okay.
Now let's try and run this. And now you'll see, first that at the outer level we have company names and orders.
Mm-hmm.
Now my object number is not drilling into the nested collection right now, but I can tell it to go in one level deeper here by adding comma one and then run. And now you'll see that I actually get a hierarchically shaped result set where I get company name and orders at the outer level, and then inside the orders collection I have order dates and totals.
Excellent.
For each customer. And of course, I can also apply ordering to this, so I could say take these guys and order by o.total descending in here. And now you'll see the result has all of the orders for each customer ordered by descending total, so I always see the top, the largest customer first.
Now, is there a limit to the number of arrays? So, you know, the dimensions?
Well, it works for a single dimensional array. So it works for anything that implements IEnumerable of T, and multidimensional arrays don't implement IEnumerable of T.
Yeah.
But it works for a list of customers or any collection that implements IEnumerable of T, which almost all of our collections do. So it's not just limited to arrays, obviously.
Sure.
Just to show you also a few other things with this stuff, maybe I should show you how it works with relational data.
Yes.
Because I'm sure people will be very interested in that. So let me try and switch to another project here and talk a little bit about this API that we have called dlink, which is the next version of the future version of ADO.NET that supports strongly typed language integrated data access. Effectively, you can use this in one of two ways. You can write a bunch of classes like customers and orders. You can write them yourself, and then you can put attributes on the classes that say this class corresponds to this table in my database, and on the properties you can put attributes that say this property corresponds to this column in the database, and then we can persist those things for you in a database.
Fantastic.
But more typically is probably that you would point at an existing database and say, please give me an object-oriented view of this database.
Yes.
And that's what I've done here with the same Northwind database. And effectively, what comes out of that then, if we look at the code here, is a strongly typed view of my database where I get a class called Northwind that contains all of the tables of the database typed as table of blah, where blah then is order or customer or whatever. And then if we scroll down a little bit, you'll see down here, here is a class customer that has a bunch of storage for the fields of a customer object, or the effectively corresponding to the columns in the database, and a bunch of properties that allow me to access. And we also have the relations map, so customers has a nested orders relation that actually maps to a join in, with the orders table in the database.
Beautiful.
And so forth. So, using this stuff now, I can actually write and access this database and write language-integrated queries.
Okay.
But I'm just going to start out by newing up a Northwind, as you see here. Then I'm going to attach a log to my Northwind connection, and you should think of this as a strongly typed connection to my database. This effectively gives me a strongly typed view of the data that's in there.
Okay.
Now I can just say db dot, and then I get, db dot, I get statement completion. You see, here we have, you know, customers right here, and I can simply just say, give me the whole customers table, and then let's run the object dumper again to see what happens there. And then the first thing you see in the dump is that we spit out, because we attached a log, we spit out the query that we sent to the database, which consisted of select address, city, company name, blah, 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 from customers. And then here we see all of the customers coming back. And effectively what we do is we fire off the query, and then we take the incoming result set and we new up objects from the result set as they come in.
Okay.
Now, let me now try and write exactly the same query, but this time against relational data. So I'm going to write from C in db.customers, where C.city equals London, select C.company name. So just what we had before.
Absolutely.
And let's try and run this. And here you see, first the query that goes across is select company name from customers, where city equals blah, and then back comes exactly the same city. And this effectively shows you how, using precisely the same query syntax, I can query either in-memory data in an array or a database. And that's sort of really the power of language integrated query, is that it gives you unification across the different domains of data. Now we do a bunch more stuff in the D-Link API. We can do change tracking to the entities that you fetch from the database. We can push the changes back by generating dynamic SQL or calling stored procedures to do the updates and so forth. So there's a whole bunch of depth behind that too, and that's all included also in the preview bits that we're giving out at the PDC.
Fantastic.
Okay, final thing I'm going to show is how does this work with XML? Because there's a lot of stuff here. Let's go back to our little demo project here, and then just try and write a little bit of XML code here. I'm just going to new up an XML element using the XLink, X-L-I-N-Q API that we have that gives us language-integrated query for XML.
Okay.
And effectively, think of this API as doing two new things for XML. First, it gives you language-integrated query capabilities, which are as powerful, really, as XPath and XQuery. It's like having the power of XQuery inside C-sharp or VB.
Okay.
The other thing we do with the XLink API is that we take all of the lessons we've learned from the W3C DOM over the last 10 years of usage, and we fix them, all of those problems, like better handling of namespaces, less memory consumption, less document centricity, et cetera, a bunch of different things that people have complained about over the years.
Okay. Well, that's great.
And so this creates a whole new exciting programming experience for XML. So let me just try first new up an element, and then just do console.writeline of that XML element and see what happens when we run. We just get an empty XML element called result. So here's one little change from the DOM. Is the toString method of an XML element gives you the XML.
Nice.
Which seems a fairly logical thing to do, but you know, we haven't done that before. Now, one of the interesting things about XLink is that an XML element has a constructor that allows you to specify the contents of the element right there as you're newing it up. So instead of having this very imperative style of construction that we have today, where you first create an element and then add child,
exactly,
and then append that to something else, well, here you just get to new it up, and then in the constructor call, say what you want to put in it.
Okay.
So one thing I might want to put in it is the string hello, for example, and now I'm just creating an element called result with the content hello, and if I do that, you'll see I get an element result with the
very
content
cool
hello. I could try and put in an attribute called hello with the value 5, for example. Let's try and run that. Oops. Oh, I should say new X attribute. Let's try and run that. And now I get result with an attribute called hello with the value 5. I could also put in a nested element called hello containing the value 5. And if I run that, I get result containing hello with the value 5.
Very nice.
As you sort of see, it's fairly intuitive how you put together the XML here and you can shape it. But the real kicker is, if what I give as an argument here is not a string, nor an element, or an attribute, but it's something that can be enumerated, like a query,
mm-hmm,
then the constructor will enumerate the query and make that the contents.
Fantastic.
So now I could say from C in customers, select new X element of contact, comma, C.company. And let's try and run this guy now. And boom.
Wow.
Now I turned my little customer array into an XML document containing all of the company names.
Fantastic.
And of course, I could control the shape of the XML in here. I might, for example, say, well, what I really want is an attribute called name containing the company name, whoops, and another attribute called phone, let's get rid of that, containing c.phone. There. Let's try and run this guy. And now you see the shape changes. I'm basically seeing contact, name equals blah, phone equals blah, name equals blah, phone equals blah. And finally, I could, of course, add a filter here and say where c.city equals London and try and run this. And now I'm actually sort of back to the same query I was writing before,
yes,
right? But this time it comes out as an XML document. So you see, again, the power of it here is that I can take data from one domain, query it, and produce data in another domain completely seamlessly, which is something that we've never been able to do.
Absolutely.
So that's sort of a real brief overview,
sure,
of the stuff that we're delivering. There's a lot of depth here. We're giving out a bunch of documentation samples that come with this. So, you know, I encourage everybody to like get a hold of it
absolutely
and play with it. Yeah.
Now, the in future incarnations, it's going to be more strongly typed in the IDE.
Yes.
So before you,
yes,
say from C in customers, then when I say C dot.
Oh, you will see statement completion.
Yes.
So far, you see we have like the colorization in there and sort of some,
sure,
basic stuff, but yes, that's why this is preview bits and not final product.
Understood. Now,
but
how
absolutely
would that work, though, for example, when I want to hit, say, the Channel 9 database,
because, mm-hmm,
I'm definitely, you know, when the time comes, I'm going to want to do this kind of stuff.
Yes.
You,
yeah,
know, SQL, cursors, I mean, I'm always going to have to do that in SQL, but I would imagine.
Right.
So I don't know why I said that, but
no,
point
well,
is,
you know, you can do it with this.
I could
stuff
do that.
Yeah,
with
yeah, yeah,
okay,
yeah, yeah.
Fantastic.
You run our tool. You point it at your database. That,
yeah,
gives you an object view of your channel line database, and,
sure,
then off you are coding in C#.
Beautiful.
Yep. Or VBE. Ultimately, this will be. This is not a C# thing.
Understood.
This is a .NET thing. So this is a capability that we're building for C# as well as for VBE.
Cool. I mean, there's still, I mean, the point is there's still going to be a lot of work that you do in the database, right? I mean, you're going to have to go in.
Sure.
You're going to have to write complex store procedures and cursors. This is a great way to have, say, on a team, you can have the DB guy create these classes and import stuff and everything, and then now you have a C-sharp guy can come in. Actually, it'll make sense to him. Oh, yeah, I need to run a query about it. I don't have to ask this person about what's in the customer's table.
Right, right.
I can do these queries.
Sure.
Simple queries.
I think, you know, there's not one single answer that fits everybody in the database space. Some people
sure.
believe in doing all the logic in the database and only calling sprocs, even for queries, which of course limits the queryability, the dynamicness of the queries, obviously.
Absolutely.
Other organizations, I see exactly the reverse. You know, they believe in putting all of the logic in the middle tier. This becomes very useful for that. Or what I probably see most typically is that you limit all modifications of the database to sprocs, but you do your querying using dynamic SQL. And that's actually a model that we support very well, because you can I talked about how we can do dynamic change tracking on these entities that you fetch from the database.
Sure.
But then when it comes time to push the changes back to the database, we can either generate insert, update, or delete statements, or we can call sprocs that do all of the modifications of the database.
Fantastic. So this is great stuff.
Yeah. I should point out, like, one of the other things, and Anders didn't get to share this example, is you can use it on any data type. So you really like SQL, it has great programming capability, you can go and reflect your registry and say select all where keys have been updated in the last couple of days and find spyware on your machine.
Nice.
You can,
well,
you
someone
can,
would have to build an object encapsulation of the registry first, but
sure.
It is entirely possible to do that.
And with reflection, absolutely any collection. So if you have, you know, you're creating a Windows app and there's 20 buttons on your screen that you want to disable, you can say, you know, find all buttons where the type is button and set enabled equals to false. So it really is the power of SQL programming across any of the different data types, whether it's objects, data, or XML. Anybody that's programming SQL will absolutely love it. So
now, could you reflect this against other objects in C#, other assemblies? Like, I mean,
one of the little demos I do is like a query to determine what are the methods of the string type, and then, you know, I don't know if you want me to show you.
Sure.
Let's do that one.
That's interesting.
Let's got this out here, and then let's put in our object number. Dot write of Q again here. Okay, so let's like write a query here. And we want to find out what are the methods of the string type.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll say from m in type of string dot get methods, which is returns an array of method infos,
okay.
Right, that we're calling m. And then from each m, we're going to select m dot name. And let's just start with that as our query. Let's try and run it. And then boom, here we see all of the methods defined in type string. Of course, the first thing we notice is they're not sorted alphabetically. So let's sort them. Order by m.name. See that. Now they all come out alphabetically. Now we might notice, oh, we're just interested in instance methods on string.
Okay.
So we don't want compare and concat and whatever the other static methods are. So we can add a where clause. Where not m is static. Because isStatic is a property on a method info, and we want all the non-static ones. And now you see that those guys went away up here. And then maybe the next thing we notice is, gosh, there are 6 index offs because of overload.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe what we want to do is we want to say group m by m.name. So group them up by name.
Okay.
And we could stop there. And just see what the shape of what comes out is. And what we see here now is we get a sequence of something that has a key field and a group field.
Okay.
The key is the thing we group by. The group field are all of the elements in that group.
Mm.
And now we could try and shape this a little bit better. So we could say take that and put it into something called G, and then select from that and we'll project out a field called method, which equals g.key, and then a field called overloads, which is the number of overloads, and that we will set equal to g.group.count, like so. So let's try and run that. And now we see a nice little dump of the methods of strings sorted alphabetically, grouped up by how many overloads there are, you know, printed out. So yeah, you can, in five lines of code, you can query anything with this
so
stuff.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
Now, yeah, because I was going to say, if you want to do that just using reflection, it's a little more laborious, but
This is using reflection.
Well, I mean
but
directly.
Yeah. Yes.
That's what
yes.
I meant.
Yes.
I mean,
yeah, nice you'd have to write a bunch of
this
for each loop,
yeah,
and then you'd have to put them in a dictionary in order to group them.
Yeah,
blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there is something to be said for the SQL syntax. Transact SQL is really pretty nifty in many ways.
Yeah, but this is like SQL.
Exactly.
It is not
understood.
SQL syntax, but it's the same idea. It's
that's
a more declarative way of stating what you want done. And that's really, I think, the big difference between this type of programming and the traditional way where today when we write our programs, a lot of the time we are not just saying what we want done, but we are in meticulous detail specifying how we want it done. Do you know what I mean? Like,
sure.
create this XML element, add it as a child of that element, and we're like writing all of these assembly-like instructions, you know, instead of stating at a higher level like this, how what we want done, and then having the system figure out how to do it.
Fantastic. Yes.
Great.
How do we get this?
So it'll be available. We'll have the tech preview bits available on MSDN. And it'll be msdn.microsoft.com/netframework/futures, and that includes everything. You just need beta 2, and you can start writing your queries with all that stuff, all the overview docs, and we'll have 101 queries on the web.
Is this another free update? Do we have to pay money for this?
No, this is totally free. It's just
how is Bill going to make any money?
A small MSI. Again, it's a tech preview, so keep those things in mind.
Okay.
And feedback is incredibly important. Right.
We will have a.
In fact, on the MSDN link that Dan mentioned, there'll be a link to forums and whatever where we'd love to hear feedback.
Okay. Sure. Very cool.
Yeah.
I think it was great from our first conversation. I think it was about a year ago when we were in the, what was it?
The museum. Yeah, I remember.
And we briefly touched and got into this discussion.
Uh-huh.
And now it's actually here.
We were in the middle of cooking this thing while we talked.
So
yeah.
When we
yeah.
come back next, what are you going to have, Sean?
I'm not telling you right now.
Yep. Anders is cooking up some more stuff.
Fantastic. Well, this is great.
Thank you for your time.
It was fun.
Nice
to meet you.
All right.
Take care.
All right. Absolutely.